Welcome to The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. And now, as they say, for something completely different. Fiction writer Rob Rentsch has won the prestigious Scott Prize for his short story collection, The Wildflowers of Baltimore. He's also an open-minded guy who's agreed to collaborate with our program this week to present an original radio adaptation of his short story, Henry. In the role of Henry, we'll hear Rob Rentsch. Henry's wife will be voiced by Carrie Gardner, and The Signal's Aaron Henkin will serve as our narrator. So, without further ado, we proudly present, from The Wildflowers of Baltimore, Henry.
Awakening. Henry David Thoreau awoke in the gray dawn light to a buzzing atop his chest. He opened the cell phone and held it in front of his face.
Why is our door locked? Where are you?
Said a young woman's voice.
I'm standing on the lawn.
There is a woman's voice in this object,
said Henry.
There's a woman on the lawn,
said the voice.
There's a breeze in her skirt.
The human voice is as water in a vacuum,
said Henry.
This is happening again, isn't it?
I can hear a voice. The air has a voice. The air has a woman's voice.
Breakfast. Henry stood in the doorway to the kitchen, watching the young woman take the carton of eggs from a transparent blue bag and then crack a few into a pale blue bowl.
I don't think you have any more sick days. You need to get off your ass and go to work like everybody else.
I am standing.
What?
I am standing. I am standing before you.
No shit.
This is where I am. I am nowhere else.
The young woman twisted a fork through the eggs, tight-lipped.
I sense a great change in the weather,
said Henry. Thinking.
There's a strange buzzing here,
said Henry, sitting at the small white kitchen table, watching the young woman pick at her well-peppered eggs.
It is all around me, and it is inside of me. The very molecules are a hum.
It's the refrigerator, Henry,
said the young woman. Henry did not respond, but turned to watch through the window. A few mostly bare branches shiver in the breeze. His hands fluttered from the table to his lap.
The pockets of these trousers,
he continued,
are not nearly large enough, and I have no sharp knife.
His gaze settled on the basket of fruit at the center of the table.
I could never have imagined such large apples. I cannot imagine the richness of the loam in the orchard of their origin.
He appraised the young woman.
I could never have imagined the skin a young woman is free to bear to the view of a stranger.
Yes,
said the young woman.
You are a stranger to me. We have never met.
I cannot help but think of the white fuzz of the underside of a rabbit just before the flesh is torn into by the butcher's tools, as all flesh must be torn into. Such must be the law of the earth, even this strange corner.
That's pleasant.
He gazed downward, between his knees, into the linoleum.
There is a pattern here. Lines the white of milk, perfect squares.
He looked up.
I should like to take a long walk,
he said.
After breakfast. After I locate a bit of pencil and a notebook. And a knife.
Excursion. Henry was kneeling at the end of the yard. His khakis were already soaked through at the knees. In front of him was a large rotted tree limb that he had overturned.
What on earth are you doing?
Said the young woman.
We're going to be late.
He looked up quickly.
I did not imagine I would be so soon discovered,
he said, his mouth slightly open in surprise.
You have been so soon discovered.
Henry appraised the young woman.
The mist this morning clings to us,
he said.
Already there is the moisture of the atmosphere in your hair.
The young woman touched her hair. It was flat and stringy, as always. It was a little damp. Henry watched her touching her hair.
I do sort of like you like this,
she said.
This is merely how I am,
he said.
What did you find in the dirt?
A worm now vanished below. A few hard-backed beetles. And these few hollows into the earth here and here,
he said, pointing.
Modest, perhaps, but magnificent caves may open from keyholes.
Traffic.
It is individuals that populate the world,
said Henry, sitting in the passenger seat of the square gray car.
These cars about us are not a stream, but a succession of separate souls, tending to the same flow by the confinement of a highway.
Would you prefer we fly across town?
Said the young woman in the driver's seat.
It is no use to wish away gravity, though one does wish it, he said.
The window was open, though the air was cool and had a tang of smoke and metal.
It is not like you to drive with the window open,
continued Henry.
I thought you didn't know who I was.
You are correct. I do not know who you are.
He paused. The license plate of the car in front of them was outlined in neon purple.
I don't understand what is happening to the world.
Right,
said the young woman.
We need to hurry the change,
said Henry.
A change of what?
What is needed first are days of unbroken contemplation, a plan. Then, assuming appropriate materials can be located amongst these pale warehouses, give me a hammer and a forest and a few bright days, and I can move the earth.
The young woman covered her mouth with her hand.
Have I amused you?
Said Henry.
A hammer, yes,
said the young woman with her hand over her mouth.
Think of what you could do with a hammer. Imagine if you had a screwdriver or a socket wrench. Think of everything that you would still not be able to fix.
Mid-morning.
What is it, Henry?
Said the young woman's voice.
Why do I find myself speaking into this object?
The phone.
It is dark as coal and smooth as a stone from a swift-moving creek.
Is it heavy?
Said the young woman's voice. Henry considered carefully.
No,
he said.
What do you want, Henry?
I don't know how this object works.
The phone.
The phone.
You do know,
said the young woman's voice.
You are using it.
Henry paused.
Remarkable,
he said.
Henry, you need to go back to work.
I remember a red dress against black windows.
What red dress, Henry David Thoreau? When have you ever been to a prom?
Henry paused.
My love, I cannot open the silver doors.
Press the button.
The button?
The light. Touch the circle of light.
Thank you. Work.
I seem to be able to manipulate the images of numbers in a window,
said Henry.
I don't believe it,
said the woman's voice on the phone.
Neither would I, were a stranger to stop me on the street with such a proposal. I assure you, I can only speak the truth.
Why does traveling in time make you lose your sense of sarcasm?
We are all travelers in time, each of us, every second.
Get back to work, Henry.
I would rather speak with you.
I wish you would say that when you were you.
I can be no other man. Do you see the two gray birds perched on the hanging span of wire?
No, Henry. You are where the birds are. I'm over here.
I often wonder if the idea of flight catches such a bird unawares, if they are surprised to find themselves suddenly in the air.
Lunch.
It is as if I am addressing the universe,
said Henry.
It's just the cell phone, Henry,
said the young woman's voice.
I am sitting on a slab of stone observing the passers-by, and I desire to share my observations and receive some in return.
Is it at least your lunch break?
Ideas and sensations born in solitude and not shared do not exist.
I see.
You see what?
A voice does not see, Henry, if I am only a voice.
But do not our eyes have ears? Do not our voices, our words, arouse sensations of texture, of cold and warmth, of the crisp snap of a bite into an apple?
Are you at least eating something?
Yes, an apple from my pocket.
Is that all you wanted? To tell me about your apple? Can I go?
I was interested to hear what you could see.
Well, Henry, I see a white wall and tiny traces of light on my eyes where I've been staring at it while we've been talking.
Ah.
Are you disappointed?
I only crave the truth.
I see.
You see what?
Just that. That's it.
There must be more in the day.
Fine, Henry. I can also taste that there's too much lemon in my tea. And I was just wishing I was 10 years old again so I could ride in the back seat of a car on a trip to the ocean.
I see a young man in a short brown jacket carrying parcels. I see a squirrel on the rim of a wire basket. There are strange, long, thin white clouds across the sky, like marks on paper.
Afternoon.
I do not like this place,
said Henry.
I know,
said the young woman's voice.
The air is cold and I cannot feel it, and my mind is overcome with buzzing. There are bees in the walls.
One more hour and then I'll be there to pick you up.
I do not understand how or why I learned to manipulate these gleaming numbers.
I know, Henry.
Be it mean or cruel, we crave only reality.
I know.
The real cold, the swift cold of a stream, with tiny silver minnows like flashes of light pointing into the pool, and even the rich cold muck beneath, the bone and shell and twig and stone, the dead, the real.
I know, Henry.
This is not real. This is not my life.
1 hour, Henry, 1 hour.
Leaving work.
I did not enjoy the time in that rectangular place,
said Henry, nearly pressing his nose to the window as the square gray car backed out of the parking slot.
Yet there is a certain melancholy in watching the building begin to recede.
You can be sad about anything,
said the young woman.
I'm relieved to hear a change in your voice,
said Henry.
I'm sitting beside you and not on the phone. Put on your seatbelt.
The light, too, has changed. There is a deeper darkness suggested in the hearts of the trees, a promise that the coming night will erase even these strange confinements, a heartening darkness. I could imagine driving into a sky pebbly with stars.
You can drive? I thought you, Henry David Thoreau, had never even conceived of such an inhuman chariot as an automobile.
Henry considered carefully.
For an instant, I was somewhere else,
he said. The car slowed to a halt.
Put on your damn seatbelt. I get sad sometimes, and I get dreamy after work, too, but that doesn't mean I want to fly through the windshield because I forgot to put on my seatbelt,
said the young woman. Henry considered. Then he pulled the buckle out and clicked it tight across his lap. Home again.
Could this really be where I live?
Said Henry.
You were just here this morning,
said the woman, slamming the door of the car and walking past Henry toward the small white house. The sunset was purple and orange just above the tips of the trees, and the earth was darker than the sky.
I know somehow that I have been here in other seasons,
he said. The woman stood on the front step to the house, watching him watch her. The door behind her was a white frame. There was a breeze in her skirt.
I do know you,
said Henry. After supper.
I sense a great change in the weather,
said Henry.
I set out apple trees this morning.
No, you didn't,
said the young woman, standing in the door to the kitchen with a glass of water.
You were at work all day.
What did I accomplish?
I'm tired, Henry. Haven't we done this enough?
I don't understand. If I was at work, what did I accomplish?
You tell me. You were there. You were awake.
I have never met a man who was truly awake. How could I have looked him in the face?
Drink your tea, Henry.
Henry looked into the cooling cup of tea on the saucer on the table before him. He picked up the cup and sipped from it, and set it down with a white clink. He looked up at the young woman, who looked down at the water she was swirling in the glass.
There is goodness in this bitterness,
he said.
You know, Henry, at least I'm not bored. At least when I'm with you, I'm not bored.
Approaching sleep.
It is very dark now. I cannot see,
said Henry.
There's a little bit of light under the window shade.
I can see the light, but nothing in the room is therefore illuminated,
said Henry. A few seconds of silence.
Where do you imagine I will go when I fall asleep?
Said Henry.
Nowhere.
Will I wake up?
You will wake up, here, with me, but you will be yourself again.
I do not wish to be only myself.
That's the way it works.
I will build a house in the woods.
No, Henry, you won't.
A few seconds of silence.
On a sidewalk in Cambridge, I saw a toad,
said Henry. There was a catch in his voice. A few seconds of silence. When he began to speak again, his voice was clear and calm in the dark.
It had hopped out from under a fence the previous evening, The toad was frozen, quite hard, in a sitting posture. I carried it into Boston in my pocket, but could not thaw it to life.
Did you put on the coffee?
I did.
A few seconds of silence.
I can hear myself breathing,
said Henry.
A radio adaptation of the short story Henry from Rob Wrench's book, The Wild Flowers of Baltimore, produced and narrated by Aaron Henkin, with Rob Wrench in the role of Henry and Carrie Gardner as Henry's wife. You can find a link to The Wild Flowers of Baltimore at our website, WIPR.org. Listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio. After the break, Dan Fesperman on his love letter to the spy novel genre, The Double Game. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. Dan Fesperman's spy novel, The Double Game, has been called a love letter to the genre, a pastiche of classic espionage tactics, characters, and the legacy of the Cold War. The book also pays homage to authors like Jean Le Carré, Graham Greene, and Ian Fleming, men who were not only spy novelists, but also, according to some accounts, spies. Fesperman joins producer Lisa Morgan in studio to talk about The Double Game.
First, let me just say that your new book, The Double Game, was a lot of fun to read.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed it, as usual. But I imagine that this one was actually a lot of fun to write. Is that
was,
true?
Yes, it was a lot of fun to write because I'm a huge fan myself of all these spy novels. So going back through a lot of the old ones and looking up ones I'd never heard of and all these little details about them, it was great fun. And also what was interesting, and because spy novels are sort of at the heart of this novel, or at least the classic ones, and how much truth they might contain, so to speak. And it was amazing, in looking into this, how many spy novelists have been spies themselves. And so you do tend to suspect that they're probably putting a lot of things in there that they could never get away with putting in a nonfiction book. They're just changing the names to protect the innocent, as they used to say on the old FBI show, or to protect themselves, more likely. And the methods they describe of the tradecraft, the way things can fail or succeed, there is an awful lot of truth in those books, and especially when you've got 18 espionage agents who are out writing novels later in life.
Yeah, that's amazing. And that sort of the leading a double life as an actual spy, but also as a well-known author. And some of them have never quite, we're not sure, there's still some suspicion about what they did or where they were and that sort of thing. See, that's so amazing that era still lives so large in our imaginations.
Yeah.
Espionage during the Cold War seems, people were fighting over this non-existent, theoretical battle. It's kind of a weird thing.
It was a weird thing, and we're sort of nostalgic for it, I think, because the lines were pretty clearly drawn, and it was easy for our people to think, well, we're the good guys, but it was also, you didn't have this enemy fighting by completely different means. They were fighting by the same means, at least on the espionage front, that we were, and their agents went to the same cocktail parties that ours did, and their operatives and employees sort of had a pact that, the émigrés would be killed and things like that, and it could get very nasty on that front. But basically, the actual agency operatives and the KGB operatives pretty much had a rule where they didn't kill each other. But I should probably explain what this book is about,
too. That's true. We should back up and say that.
Yeah, it's at the center of this book is a spy novelist, an American spy novelist who had quite a successful career, has had a successful career writing spy fiction and was a CIA agent or a CIA operative himself for 16 years. And my main character, however, was a Foreign Service brat. He grew up in the Cold War, kind of living in Cold War capitals where all these books were set. And he would acquaint himself with these cities he was moving to about every 3 years, moving around, as Foreign Service brats do, by reading spy novels. And his favorite was this author, Ed LeMaster. And he comes to suspect later in life, in present time, he comes to believe that maybe Ed LeMaster was himself a double agent, and that his magnum opus, which had the title The Double Game, which is also the title of this book, he comes to wonder if maybe there was a lot more truth in there about the author himself instead of the villain of the book.
Yes, and he sort of gets drawn in and has a chance to explore that whole theory very close and in a personal way.
Yes, and someone is leading him into this chase. He doesn't know who, but someone who seems to know as much about spy novels as he does. And they're kind of leading him into this chase by dropping clues along the way, which are often torn from the pages of spy novels. Not just Ed LeMaster's, but John Le Carré's, Eric Ambler's, Graham Greene's, a host of other books.
Mm-hmm. And so he has a chance to go back to these European cities that he used to live in and
yes.
see the sort of change, which I thought you, as a foreign correspondent during mm-hmm. the 90s for the Baltimore Sun,
yeah.
did you have a chance to revisit those cities?
I did. Yeah, I did. I went back to Vienna, to Prague, to Budapest. Those are the three main cities where this book is set. And they were the three places where Bill Cage, the main character, he spent a lot of his youth in those three places. It's where he first fell in love in Vienna. And it's where he did a lot of things that he sort of always wondered about, little errands that his father sent him on, his father being a diplomat, and now has begun to wonder whether some of those errands also weren't involved in some sort of espionage courier racket. So
yeah.
He's a little mystified as to what his life was really like in those days and wants to figure it out.
Well, and what was the inspiration? How did this idea come to you?
It came to me very suddenly. Usually ideas kind of creep up on me for books, and it's sort of this slow courtship, and, you know, I have to decide, well, how faithful can I be to this idea? Am I going to still love it a year and a half from now when I'm trying to finish the book? And this one was more like, you know, this whirlwind Vegas marriage. You know, it's like hit me like a ton of bricks, and I was married to it within 2 hours. I was doing some research for an outside project I'm doing where I was interviewing a lot of ex-CIA people from the late 40s, the early 50s, the earliest day of the agencies. And so I had that spinning around in my head, all of that material. And I went online and was looking up information on Kim Philby, the British double agent who had fooled a lot of Americans when he was based in Washington. And for some reason, that turned up an interview with author John Le Carré that he had done a few years back with the Guardian newspaper in Britain, in which he admitted that he had toyed with the idea when he was working for MI6 of being a double agent, mostly just to find out what it was like on the other side, to see what really happened over there and what that was like. And this clicked with me partly because I'd gotten to interview him back at Johns Hopkins when he visited there, I think in 1986, when he came to, he gave a lecture and his book, A Perfect Spy, was out. So it reminded me of that and how impressed I had been with him, and I was wondering how I would have handled it as a journalist if he had made this admission, and because I think The Guardian sort of overhyped it a little bit and made a little sensation. So my character, Bill Cage, the book begins with a flashback to 1984, which is more Orwellian in tone, and I liked it for that, and when the Cold War was still quite strong. And when he got to interview his favorite author, Ed LeMaster, the American Le Carré, and he does make the admission to him, and he does overhype it a little and feels kind of shamed by that afterwards. And then years later, when he's out of journalism and a burned-out PR man, he gets this anonymous tip saying, you know, you should have dug deeper. And so that's where he sets out on this quest. So that it all came together for me. Within 2 hours of reading this interview, I was written a rough for the first 20 pages of the book. And I was about 150 pages into another manuscript, and I got in touch with my publisher and sent him this, cleaned up this 20 pages and sent it. And I said, you know, here's another idea, and I really would kind of like to do this, and I'm excited by this. And he took a look, and he said, you know, I like it too. Why don't you go ahead and run with it?
Wow.
While it's fresh and while you feel great about it. So I did. So I put the other book down, which I still will finish and like, but this one kind of bowled me over. And so it came about very quickly.
Now, do you have, you mentioned Le Carré.
Yeah.
Are there others that are super favorites of yours, like spy novelists over the time?
I'd like to mention one, an American writer who's outstanding. And if you're a spy novel fan, you probably know about him, Charles McCary. And he had been with the CIA for a long time. He was sort of a deep background agent in Europe and hasn't really talked much about what he actually did. But he's getting up in years now, but he's published a lot of excellent spy novels and just has never been quite as well known, but he's a fine writer. So that's just one right mm-hmm. there. Graham Greene, he's written a lot more than just spy novels, but he's had a few of those that were outstanding as well, and sort of other novels of international intrigue, some of which he called entertainments, some of which he just stuck with novel. I guess he thought they were serious enough for that. But those come to mind right away. Adam Hall, who you don't hear much about anymore. He had these Quiller novels in those days. Another fun thing is at the end of the book, Bill Cage's father collected these spy novels. And the end of the book has all of his father's collected books listed by author and by year and by title. And so including Ed LeMaster's. I've already gotten an email of somebody asking me, where can I find Ed LeMaster's books? And I told them, I said, you know, they're usually on the shelf next to Kilgore Trout's, who was the fictional science fiction writer that Kurt Vonnegut wrote about. Although I think someone did later publish a Kilgore Trout novel.
Well, you never know. You could have a whole other secret life writing these LeMaster's.
Or if someone else wants to write an Ed LeMaster novel using that pen name, that's fine by me.
See, now when I finish the book and I turn to the appendix, and it's listed, it's like 222 books.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that would give you a place to look, excluding the LeMaster's.
Yeah, but they stop in 1989 because Bill and his father both sort of lost their passion for spy novels when the Berlin Wall came down. They it kind of shut it down for them. So it is a limited collection chronologically. But for instance, Alan First, a very popular writer now of spy novels, he only had one before 1989. So only one of his books made Mr. Cage's collection.
Now, see, as I turn the page, I see these numbers are in boldface and certain names, and I'm thinking, is there a code in here for me to find?
Well, there is. The authors who are bold-faced in that appendix were in intelligence work themselves.
Now, what is your feeling of how the CIA and these secret intelligence people, how do they feel about these novels? Do they have what kind of relationship do they have with these guys?
Oh, well, a fair amount of them write them. So I've got to feel like they can't feel too bad about them. They wouldn't keep putting them out. I talked to one of the former CIA people who I had interviewed had written three, and they were quite good. William Hood, he had been a top assistant to James Angleton, the counter spy and the mole hunter. And one of his books, actually a reference to it, turns up in my book. But I found another, James McCargar, a former CIA man, published a nonfiction book, and I hope I'm not messing up the title. I think it's called A Short Course to the Secret War. A Short Course in the Secret War, or something like that. It was basically a kind of a manual on spy tradecraft. You know, not great detail, but kind of a general manual. And in it, I remember in his first pages, he wrote about how he has always found that the greatest truths written about what really goes on in this business tend to be in novels. So I think that they have great respect for a certain type of spy novel. I don't think they have much respect for James Bond novels, even though they may think they're great fun, and even though that was written by a former intelligence agent, Ian Fleming. But the Le Carré type novels that really take pains to, you know, try to be authentic in their tradecraft and whatnot, I think they enjoy those because they feel like, yeah, this is more the way it works than maybe a nonfiction account you'll find of this.
Yeah, plus it makes it seem pretty sexy and exciting.
Yeah. And also when they're writing books, if a CIA agent writes a book, nonfiction, they pretty much have to get it all cleared and redacted and all of that. If they write a novel, it's a lot more leeway and stuff will slip in. You know, they're not going to give away all their secrets, but things do slip in there that wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah. Well, like I said, this was a great read, a lot of fun traveling around. I was dizzying all the cities we visit and all the things he does. And thanks for coming in and talking about it.
Thanks. It was great fun.
Dan Fesperman is the author of 8 novels. His latest is The Double Game. For The Signal, I'm Lisa Morgan.
You're listening to The Signal, an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Still ahead, Lewis Campbell talks with us about the meaning of ceremonial dance, the art of handcrafted beadwork, and the life of Lumbee people in Baltimore City. That's coming up right after the break. Welcome back to The Signal. I'm Andy Bienstock. We conclude our program this week with a Lumbee proverb. Seek wisdom, not knowledge. Knowledge is of the past. Wisdom is of the future. With these words in mind, producer Aaron Henkin introduces us to Baltimore resident Lewis Campbell.
One of my friends up in Pennsylvania made this drum for me. It's out of deer hide. It's a powwow drum. I'll let you hear a basic drum beat. This isn't the Hollywood drum beat. This is a regular drum beat that we do. It's the heartbeat of our people. That's what your heart sounds like. It's the heartbeat of Mother Earth.
When he's outfitted in his full complement of handmade regalia, Lewis Campbell is a kaleidoscope of red, yellow, black, white, and green. Tassels, fringe, fur, feathers, and intricate beadwork cover him from head to toe. And his face, painted bone white, is accentuated by black lines that come down from the corners of his green eyes. He admits the whole ensemble is extremely heavy, and in the summer it can get witheringly hot. But when he's dancing, none of that matters.
This is my dance stick, or coup stick. It has eagle feathers on it and an eagle's talon with a spear coming through it. I have bear claws on it, and I also have my eagle wing fan, which I put some beadwork on and some leather work, and it keeps me cool while I'm dancing. It gets really hot out there when you're dancing sometimes, like 100-some degrees, and this will, you know, keep you pretty cool. All the dancers have different backgrounds and from different areas. But my dance is one of the oldest dances. It's Northern traditional dance. It's the warrior's dance. We're telling a story about a battle or a hunt. Each song is about a 4-minute song, but then you have competitions to where you'll dance 3 to 4 songs back to back. And then you have songs that somebody can put their fan on the drum because they love the song so much, and that song keeps on going again. So you can dance for like 20 minutes straight sometimes.
That's how you request an encore? You put your fan on the drum?
Yeah, but you have to... You have to be a veteran of the dancing to be able to do that. You have to have an eagle fan to do that, or blow an eagle whistle, which is real spiritual. The only way you're allowed to have an eagle whistle is to be a sun dancer.
Everything has got a meaning to it, doesn't it? I mean, everything is a sort of a symbol for something in the social order or spiritual order.
Correct. Yeah, everything that we do, everything that we wear has a meaning to it. And even though the dancing, we're not allowed to dance backwards. We're not allowed to dance in a circle because that represents that you're perfect. And you're not allowed to dance backwards because warriors don't retreat. So everything has a meaning.
Lewis Campbell travels to powwows up and down the East Coast, where he dances in organized competitions. He says he tries to get to one every weekend, if he can. Campbell comes from the Lumbee people, but he feels camaraderie with natives from all the different tribes at the powwows. He calls them a second family, and he says they all look forward to getting away from their lives in the different cities to spend time together. Baltimore became a destination for people from the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina back in the 1940s and 50s. They left their lives as tenant farmers and came to the city for construction and factory jobs. Since then, they've become an ironic modern entity known as the urban Indian. The Census Bureau indicates that Baltimore Lumbees have an average education level of 8th grade, an unemployment rate of around 18%, and an average income that puts 35% of Lumbees below the poverty line. When I met Lewis Campbell, he wasn't wearing his dance regalia. He was in jeans and a black T-shirt, sitting in front of his computer, up on the third floor of the Native American Lifelines building on Clay Street.
I'm the culture director here. I teach dancing. We do drumming, beadwork, crafts. We have storytelling, and we also cook traditional foods here. And plus, Native American Lifelines is a health organization for just natives, and we have a dental program to where any Native American on Tuesdays can come get their teeth done for free. And we have substance abuse counselors, domestic violence, mental health, and a few other things that we do here. We have a pool party every year, a Christmas party every year, and we're trying to throw a powwow every year now.
Talk about some of the struggles economically that the Lumbee people have and where they stand on this sort of economic ladder.
Well, the problem with a lot of Lumbees, they don't fit in anywhere. You know, they don't fit in with blacks, they don't fit in with whites or Hispanics, because we are different no matter what, how we look. We're completely different culturally. And if we don't have centers like this, there's nowhere for them to go to feel comfortable. So honestly, we need centers like this for the Lumbee to fit in somewhere. That's why a lot of them drop out of school, because they don't fit in. And they try to fit in certain branches, different people, but they just don't. So honestly, that's one of the biggest problems why they are so poor, is because a lot of them don't finish school.
I guess, you know, you sort of have this outsider status to white folks and then also all the different ethnic minorities as well. You're just like a double outsider almost.
Correct. And then with a lot of Lumbees, we have, a lot of us have curly hair, a lot of us have green eyes, and a lot of us just don't fit the description of a Native American. We don't fit the stereotype. So when they look at you, they don't see Indian.
It must be an interesting experience to have this Native American heritage and be living a contemporary urban life. I mean, you talk about a wife and kids. You live here in Baltimore City. You got a day job. I mean, talk about what your daily life is like and how that compares to when you get out to a powwow on the weekends.
Honestly, the only time I feel myself is that when I am in a powwow. But I grew up in Baltimore. I've always been around it. I love going out hunting and fishing and all that stuff, but I'm used to the city. I didn't grow up completely around natives. I was adopted as a child, so I was never around any Lumbees or never even heard Lumbee until I was like 15 years old. So it's a little strange.
Tell me more about that. Talk about the family that you grew up in and all of a sudden when you realized that you had this link to this heritage.
I grew up in a lot of different foster homes, group homes, all that stuff. But when I turned like almost 16 years old, my real mother got in contact with me. So that's when I heard about Lumbees, when I moved to Baltimore to see her. And then when I met them, you know, it didn't really work out. So I've been on my own since I was like 16. I went down to the Baltimore American Indian Center to try to find something, you know, to fit in. And then that's how I got connected to my culture. I always knew I was Indian, but I always thought I was Cherokee. That's what I was told growing up my whole life. And that's what my grandmother actually said she was until she died. But when I moved to Baltimore, I realized what I actually was. I just embraced it, and I just haven't stopped since. I've tried to learn as much as possible about my culture, about dancing, and I want to teach people about it. That's why I'm here.
Talk to me about the federal government and the Lumbees. Lumbee people are not a federally recognized tribe. Is that true?
We are a federally recognized tribe. We're federally recognized since the 50s, but the problem is we don't get the full benefits as other tribes do because we're such a large tribe and there's a lot of money involved. But we've been federally recognized to be Native Americans since the 50s.
It must feel like a strange irony to have this outside party deciding who of your people is officially or not officially a tribe anyway, right?
That's true. I don't understand it, but I know what I am, so I don't have to have a government tell me what I am.
For Lewis Campbell, that sense of identity is unassailable when he's dressed in his dance regalia, wearing 4 years' worth of custom hand-sewn beadwork, holding an eagle feather fan in one hand and an eagle talon dance stick in the other.
When I'm in my regalia, I feel powerful. I feel strong, and I just feel happy. It's the only time I feel like that. I really enjoy dancing. I'm very social when I'm dancing. Any other time, I'm real shy. But when I'm in my regalia, I'm not shy at all. And when you're dancing, it's another form of prayer. So that is the reason Native Americans dance. The ceremonial dances and the powwow dancing is a form of prayer in motion.
Lumbee ceremonial dancer Lewis Campbell talking with the Signal's Aaron Hankin. Campbell is the culture director at Baltimore's Native American Lifelines. The organization is online at nativeamericanlifelines.org. And that's going to wrap things up for this week's episode of The Signal. We love to hear your thoughts and questions about the program. You can always reach us through our website, WIPR.org, where you'll find on-demand audio and podcasts of the program. We're on Facebook, too, and you can check us out there at Signal Radio Baltimore. The Signal is an original production of Your Public Radio in Baltimore. Our theme music comes to us from Wendell Patrick, and the show is produced by Lisa Morgan and Aaron Hankin. For 88.1 WIPR, your NPR news station, I'm Andy Beanstock. Thanks for listening.